are at Harrah's and Harvey's in Lake Tahoe. We're talking about the future and the neural information processing systems, NIPS, with four people: John Platt from Microsoft Research, Terry Sinofsky from Salk, UCSD, who's also president of the NIPS Foundation, Hannah Wallach from University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and Mike Mosher from the University of Colorado Boulder. And what we're trying to get some sense of is how this thing has evolved, and also why we're here. Terry, maybe you'd start.
Well, this year NIPS is having its 25th anniversary. The first meeting was held in Denver in 1987, and the first 14 meetings were held in Denver before I moved to Vancouver and had 10 meetings in Vancouver. This year we're going to be in Granada, Spain. It's our first meeting in Europe. And in 2002, we'll be back here in the U.S. in South Tahoe, and that's why we're here.
2012. Right. For the duration.
We have a three-year contract, and we tend to stay in place.
Yeah. So, but give me some sense of why we're here. Has it just grown, or?
Well, NIPS started out with, say, 400 people at the first meeting, and it grew to the point where now, at the last meeting in Vancouver, we had over 1,300 unique registrants, and we outgrew the hotels there. We also have a workshop that it takes place after the conference, and in Vancouver that was in Whistler. Here we're co-located in South Tahoe. This is a outdoor area where there's skiing in the winter, and so we won't have to be breaking up the meeting and spending a half a day busing everyone out to the ski area. So we're going to be here in South Tahoe for the entire week.
You've got a growing number of younger members as well, but they may not know some of the history of this thing. John, let me go to you that for a moment there. My reading suggests that although NIPS itself first met in 1987, that there was a history before that, mm-hmm. but there were these things called Hopfests. John Hopfield, from 84 to 86, put together by Ed Posner. Could you gloss that for me? Give me some sense of who those people are and what's going on there.
Sure. Well, in the mid 80s, there was a tremendous amount of excitement about trying to build computational systems that were modeled on the brain. There was a tremendous amount of hope that this could be like a new paradigm of computing. And so we started at Caltech with just a set of people who drove in, and we just had chalk talks that was called the Hopfest, after John Hopfield, who had made one of the more popular models of cognition back in 1982. Right. And so those were just chalk talks, and they got more popular in 84. And then in 85, we actually made an official meeting in Santa Barbara on the beach. And that was interesting because that had had both researchers and, in fact, a lot of government people and a lot of, army people or Navy people were interested in that. And then it grew even further, and so we outgrew. That was just in a small hotel in Santa Barbara. We started an invitation-only workshop at the Snowbird Ski Resort in 1986, and that was immediately oversubscribed. We had room for 100 people, and many people tried to crash the meeting, and it was all just terribly exciting because everyone was just so excited. So then we decided to split the meetings to make NIPS be the more formal conference in 1987, and then they kept the Snowbird workshop, which has actually gone on to this day.
So, Mike, you've been at these meetings from the beginning?
Since 1988.
Yeah. So what distinguishes, and you've used this phrase, NIPSology or NIPSoids, what distinguishes this group of people from, say, the people who go to the Society for Neuroscience or the other meetings like COSINE and so on? What's the theme here? What's the story?
The common belief that a formal, principled, theoretical approach is key to understanding and developing powerful tools and tools for modeling the brain as well as for doing machine learning.
But it's very much based in math, right? It's algorithmic and...
Yes.
As opposed to behavioral.
I think as you mentioned, the Society for Neuroscience meeting, that's an enormous meeting with over 25,000 participants, of which only a very small number you know, a few hundred are interested in mathematical models of the brain. Yeah. And NIPS attracts those people, the people who have mathematical or engineering backgrounds, who are trying to analyze the very large data sets that neuroscientists collect, and also trying to understand some of the basic principles. And I think that the brain is inspiring because it's the only existence proof that, in fact, a lot of difficult problems in vision, speech recognition, motor control can actually be solved, which are still unsolved today in the area that in engineering areas.
Is this a women's field?
No.
Or rather, there are not that many women who are participating in machine learning and neuroscience from a more mathematical point of view. And this is something we're really actively working to change. So I, along with Jennifer Wortman Vaughan and Lisa Wehner, founded the Women in Machine Learning Workshop in 2006, really with the idea that we really wanted to change this. And the idea actually grew out of NIPS. The three of us were sharing a hotel room in 2005 at NIPS, and we're just amazed that we found some other women at the conference. And we thought, well, we'll put together a workshop for other women and see if we can actually bring people together. And by 2006, we'd put together a workshop, which was actually co-located with the Grace Hopper Conference in the first year. It was an enormous success. We had over 100
Grace
women.
Grace Hopper, the legendary figure from...
That's right. There's a Women in Computing Conference that's held every year known as the Grace Hopper Conference. And the first Women in Machine Learning Workshop was co-located there. It was a fantastic success with 100 women participating. We subsequently held the workshop with Grace Hopper the next year and then moved to co-locate with NIPS in 2008. And at this point, we're very happy co-locating with NIPS. There are many reasons why it's really an ideal conference to co-locate with.
Right. So do you have any sense of the breakdown in terms of male, female, age, and so on? Well, what's the profile of NIPS?
I can't give you the exact numbers, but I can tell you this, that the number of women who have been coming to NIPS has been increasing from, I think, 2 at the first meeting to now there are probably several hundred. And I think having the Wimmel group has been a big boost. But the other factor that I think has been overwhelming is the number of students who attend. And we have NIPS actually sponsors student travel for students who are going to be presenting posters and oral talks at the meeting. And I think it's really a tribute to the fact that Hannah, as a student, picked NIPS of all the meetings that she could have gone to. She picked NIPS as the one that would be her home.
Right. So the profile has been changing from what you described historically as a kind of in-group of people who are all enthusiasts to a wider perspective and wider mission, right?
And there's this tremendous energy because every year there's a new crop of grad students who are bringing new mathematical techniques in, and these are us old timers look around and say, we don't recognize any of these faces and we don't know the techniques people are using because they change from year to year.
So in terms of talking about computational models of various things, and the brain as this obvious device that we all have sitting 3 pounds of wonder tissue on the end of our spinal columns, what else can you possibly talk about? Do you have trouble with a general audience? Terry, you talk to audiences a lot of the time. Convincing them that that's where they what they should be thinking about, or do they feel like it's too reductionistic?
I think general audiences are fascinated by what we're doing. They may not understand it, but it's clear that we underappreciate the difficulty of many problems because we're so good at seeing and picking up a coffee cup. Those turn out to be the most difficult computational problems, and no one, based on intuition, could have guessed it in early days of artificial intelligence. You know, it's been a long time since computers have been around now, since the 50s, and one of the first things they did was to program it to play games and chess, and we know those games now are played by computers better than humans, but there are no computers that can interact with humans on their own terms. We're beginning to get computers that interact, for example, emotionally, but it's still early days. And NIPS has really been at the vanguard of this effort to try to understand what are the basic principles that allow brains to compute so rapidly and so efficiently.
So tell me the story about the recent successes of the computer playing the game on TV.
Well, who would like to handle that? Why don't you take that?
So you're talking about the Watson system from,
yes.
From IBM? Yeah, so that was actually very interesting. There's been a long interest in sort of both machine learning and natural language processing in question answering.
Right.
And only recently has there been enough computing power. I don't know that the IBM Watson team actually made a system that would be sort of have enough knowledge and be fast enough with a bunch of parallel computing to actually sort of compete in with Jeopardy with real players. And the key there was sort of the massive parallel computing and also a kind of style of architecture that has been very popular in NIPS, which is called these ensembles. So maybe you can't build one perfect algorithm for doing any particular task, but you can get hundreds of pretty good algorithms, and sort of aggregating them together makes something that's much better. That's something that many of us have learned. That was a lesson that they learned too, and they applied, and they had this very good question answering system.
So, but go for a general audience, I mean, you almost think about this, go from that, which looks like this extraordinary success, mm-hmm. and obviously computers can do anything, they can win at Jeopardy, but in terms of what you're talking about, in terms of simply even emotions and so on, there's a huge rift there. I mean, there's a huge, how do you see NIPS and the work that people work in NIPS doing, filling that gap, going from simple...
Well, we're talking here about cognitive science, and
yes.
I think, like many other areas, it's a small part of NIPS, but it's a very important part because it's trying to model and understand basic principles of cognitive processing and his area that Mike works in, and maybe he could tell us a little bit about that area.
Terry earlier alluded to the fact that many of these abilities we have that seem so simple and natural to us are the ones that are difficult for computing. And you described Watson, which is deals with language and higher level reasoning and thought. But that higher cognitive abilities are built on an infrastructure of abilities to perceive, attend, react to the environment. And so those non-linguistic abilities are areas where we still have a long ways to go to match the human flexibility and human ability to learn and perform.
Hannah, a lot of your stuff is, I mean, apart from your professional stuff, you also do stuff that's dealing with the impact of your work on society.
Mm-hmm.
So you must talk to general audiences about this sort of thing, and you must have to deal with this issue of how remote is this work from their actual day-to-day lives. I mean, how do you bridge that gap?
Right, and I mean, that's a really good question. I think it's really important for us as scientists to think about what the fundamental message is of our work. So there's no point if we as scientists are doing fantastic work if we can't communicate that with a general audience. And I therefore think it's really important for people to actually think about how to communicate what they're doing, what the impact is, what are the analogies that are most useful in understanding this, and what are the ways that, you know, this sometimes really mathematical work can connect with what people are actually thinking about on a day-to-day level. And I think these are just really important questions that we as an entire community should be thinking about really a lot more and continuing to think about over the next few years.
So Terry, is that something you should be having on the agenda for future NIPS meetings? I mean, science and society component?
I think that everybody personally, individually has the responsibility to communicate to the public, because after all, they're paying for the research we're doing. But it's not easy, and I can tell you my experience. I wrote a book with Steve Quartz, Liars, Lovers, and Heroes.
Yes,
and I've written monographs. I've written many scientific papers, over 300 scientific papers. That was by far the most difficult piece of prose I've ever had to write. And the reason is that I had to, as the instructions I was given is, you know, try to explain this to your mother. And for a general audience, you really need to find the right metaphors, the right way to give, if not in a technical mathematical way, but in a sense, for what are the basics and what impact does this have on everyone's lives? Trying to understand, why did I react to somebody that way? You know, what's going on in my brain? These are questions we all ask ourselves, but it's only recently that neuroscientists have actually got to the point where we can answer some of those questions.
And as we were saying before, mathematics is really this common language that everybody attending NIPS uses to communicate with each other, be it, you know, whether their application area is in vision or language or more cognitive science, that kind of thing. And so it's very tempting when communicating, at least among ourselves, to use mathematics. But of course, that's not the language that the general public is working with. So the real trick there is to move away from our own shared common language and actually situate our work using a language that the public is actually familiar with.
Do you think that the NIPS membership, the meeting, would rebel if you injected a science and society perspective, just one lecture or something like that? Or do you think they'd welcome it?
Well, we'll bring it up at the next board meeting. But seriously, I think that this is not something that it's not just NIPS that is concerned about this. For example, the Society for Neuroscience, we mentioned them earlier,
yes.
They now have created a keynote lecture in which they bring, you know, major cultural figures in, you know, architects and authors and movie actors. Glenn Close, I think, was the last one, and to talk about
Frank Gehry,
the architect, to kind of explain what they do and relate it to the issues and the concerns that the neuroscientists have, and they've been very, very popular and very successful.
But NIPS has been good about that on a smaller scale. The invited talks to the conference are almost always folks who are coming from outside of the NIPS community who bring a broader perspective, at least within the sciences.
Well, tell me what the community is. I mean, we just did, and it's up on the website right now, you know this, the Cognitive Science Meeting 2011. And there's an interview I did there with Barbara Landau. And they quite clearly were seeking to increase their reach. So they were bringing in people from vision, people from AI, people from language, and so on.
Well, we already have all those. We've been doing that for 25 years.
What is your constituency, though?
All of the above?
Yes. So
people, they speak math.
Yes, and have, but you know, it doesn't have to be pure math. A lot of rigorous experimental work gets published at NIPS. Rigorous algorithmic work. I'll leave you to comment on whether it's neuroscience experimental. I don't know how much that
Programs.
But programs, right? So people write down. People make do computer science. People do programs. They do experiments on the programs. They write down math to generate the programs. They talk to each other about what their results have been, what theorems they can prove. It's very exciting.
And their backgrounds are from almost every area of science and engineering. There are people who are interested in vision. You mentioned vision, computer vision.
Right.
People from natural language processing. People who are interested in robotics. People who are interested in the brain. People are interested in mathematics. People are interested in, you know, every aspect in which you're struggling with, and I'm going to be a little bit technical, high dimensional spaces, you know, thousands of variables. Huge data sets, you know, terabytes of data. How do you sort through that and find out, you know, the gems? And this is why we developed these computer algorithms, to be able to help us navigate through all the data. And of course, that's what our brain is doing right now.
Right. So how do you see the field developing over the next occupancy of Tahoe?
Next
few years.
I guess my perspective, again, this is my perspective again, is that we are sort of feeling our way towards making something vaguely brain-like, and it's sort of like the whole internet and search engines and everyone sort of cooperating. This is going back to like what Hannah does with crowdsourcing. So I think that a lot of these large data sets, they're being just generated by people who are just naturally doing the work. Maybe it's scientists generating their data, it's people making web pages, it's search engines indexing things. So I think that my guess is that will get increasingly popular, that there's just sort of this interconnected data web across the world, and people are going to start working on it and figuring out what to do with it. And so there's a lot of common tools that everyone will have on that.
So I wrote an essay, which was only slightly tongue-in-cheek, on when will the internet become conscious of itself.
John Brockman's
right,
book.
John Brockman, right, yeah.
So, but let's deal with that thing, because I'm just going, as you know, in October, going up to Deauville to the Women's Global Forum, and I'm doing a panel there with a number of people, and the theme is basically, began by being the statement, you know, is the internet damaging you or doing good? I mean, what's digital culture like? You're talking about the wisdom of crowds, Clay Shirky's term, right?
Yes, that's right.
What's your sense from talking to general audiences about whether they feel like the internet is dumbing them down or lifting them up, raising them up? I mean, what's the world like AG, in the era AG after Google?
Well, I think it's both in many ways. On just a personal day-to-day, minute-to-minute level, the internet, people definitely feel that the internet is dumbing them down. They feel less of an obligation to remember things and all of that kind of stuff, because you can look it up.
That.
Absolutely, and you can look this kind of stuff up really, really easily. But simultaneously, it gives any individual a much greater ability than they would have had if they were working in isolation without, you know, direct access to all of these resources. So I think it's really both at the same time.
I mean, there was a paper in Science last week, a paper about the fact that you were not necessarily remembering in accurate detail what the information was you were accessing, although you were accessing it more effectively. Do you remember that paper?
I actually don't know that particular paper, but that's exactly the kind of point that I'm trying to make here, yes.
So Roger, let me remind you how TSN reaches its audience.
Right. On the web.
So hopefully the people watching this are being benefited, I hope.
Right. Yes, but we always say that we're actually free of the tyranny of the soundbite. We actually keep these things at full length. You can watch them at length. You can go forward, you can go backwards, you can do whatever you want with them. Mm-hmm. It's not being fed to you in a prepackaged form, so. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the important things that the web can do.
But that's also a huge cost, because there's...
Compared to traditional broadcast media, which has been edited. So that's a good thing. Yes? No?
Well, but there's a huge cost, because now there's so much information out there. And
how do you find out what stuff is relevant and what's not?
And the work that goes on at places like Microsoft, it tries to do some distillation and digestion, and the modeling that's done at NIPS helps support that.
So, how does that work?
Oh, so I mean, a lot of Microsoft products help people deal with information overload. I mean, so there's, you know, there, if I can talk a little bit about Microsoft, you know, we have the search engine called Bing, and so there's a huge amount of mathematics that sort of goes into making a search engine, and a lot of it is related to stuff that has been done at NIPS, and that's again to distill these petabytes of information down to an answer that you might be able to use.
I recently switched from Google to Bing.
Well, thank you.
Or
even, you know, products like Outlook, that there are you know, tools in there to help filter out spam. And again, those are very based on NIP style algorithms to try to make little decisions about, oh, okay, this is something that you probably don't want to look at, and this is something you probably do.
So one of the principal architects of Bing is Paul Viola, mm-hmm. who used to be a graduate student in my lab while he was doing his PhD from MIT. So yeah. Shows you how all these things are related.
He's now a distinguished engineer.
And I just want to pick up on something John was saying about using these vast quantities of information to make decisions. There was a really interesting article in the New York Times a week or two ago about decision fatigue and about how people are constantly making decisions. And at the beginning of the day, you know, when they wake up and they're feeling awake and refreshed, they're really able to make good decisions. But over the course of the day, as they're forced to make decision after decision after decision, they become fatigued and exhibit reduced willpower and all of this kind of stuff. And I think a lot of the things that all of these algorithms are trying to do is help people make decisions such that they don't suffer from decision fatigue, such that this can actually be reduced and they can be more effective in their day-to-day lives.
Decision fatigue?
Yes. I think this is
an interesting concept.
I think we're actually touching on something that's changed, I would say, in the last 10 to 15 years at NIPS. Back in 1990, there was a lot of people, I mean, it's a continuum, but a lot of people were dreaming about autonomous intelligence and how we can make a brain in a box. And now that we're in 2011, I think we're really thinking about how to sort of supplement, you know, how to complement people. In other words, instead of thinking about AI as a separate thing just in its own sort of academic field, is, oh, here we've got sort of, you know, people and all of society, and here we've got our algorithms. How can we kind of blend them together to make sort of the best of both
so
worlds?
So let me give you an example of that. This comes from my early work on neural networks. You know,
with NetTalk?
With NetTalk. But it was another group that had developed something called a network, I've forgotten what it was called, but it was a network that analyzed pap smears. Mm-hmm. So women have these tests every year to see if they have cervical cancer. And and if a human being has to sit there who's a trained expert and look for one out of a million cells that is cancerous, right? And it takes hours and hours and hours to screen. And it's mind-numbing because, you know, you're sitting there all day. Well, what they did was, and that to train a network up on identifying those few cancer cells, and it turned out what they discovered is that not only do you need to give them examples of cancer cells, you need to give them examples of all the debris and all the negatives as well. So they needed a tremendous amount of data. Finally, they got it to work, and it wasn't perfect. It was only able to, 50, you know, it was picking up a lot of false positives, but it was able to take the millions of examples and reduce it to a few thousand that then a human being can come in and examine in detail, because those are the ones that are really the borderline cases that only a human could really make the call on. But the point, though, was that it went from hours and hours to minutes. It saves a huge amount of human time. And this has, I think, become a pattern of developing tools and techniques that allows humans to use their processing power more efficiently and to cover many more areas.
In the same way as we talk about, when we're talking about the science of educating, the Temporal Dynamics of Learning Center, we're talking about Javier Mervain's robots and so on in the classrooms. The robots becoming almost like teachers' aides, so that teachers are more effectively doing what they're good at and not spending all their time doing trivial tasks.
Well, there you go. Yeah, that's another good example.
Computers and humans are good at different things. And the real question is how we can get them to both do the things that they're good at. So using computers to do the kinds of tasks that humans find boring and tedious and make mistakes on when they perform them over a long period of time, and then using humans to actually deal with these tasks that require a lot of background or intuition, prior knowledge, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about your stuff on crowds and so on. What's the relevance there, and how does it fit into this world?
So broadly speaking, I work on computational social science. So it used to be the case that social science was primarily very much observation-based, survey-based, small-scale groups of people looking at, in great detail, all of the connections between people. And obviously with the invention of computers and the internet and all of this kind of stuff, we just have vastly more information available. So the question is how to develop techniques to analyze these quantities of information in order to draw conclusions about complicated social systems at a scale that was just not previously possible. And there are many different directions that this takes. I typically work a lot with networks of people who are communicating and collaborating with each other and analyzing their communications and collaborations, not just via networks structure, but also via the documents that they're using to communicate with each other. When scientists are collaborating, they write papers. This is a way of communicating with other scientists. And so I'm really interested in actually analyzing these data, both in terms of the documents themselves, but also the network structure that they're situated in order to better understand these kinds of complicated social systems. And another side of that is these kinds of crowdsourcing systems, where tasks are being divided up into small chunks and being farmed out to really large numbers of people who can effectively and quickly put very little time into completing their bit of the task, and then everything can be brought back together such that the overall task is accomplished without any single one individual or one system performing the entire thing themselves.
And you end up with algorithms from that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And people have done huge amounts of work on studying algorithms for dividing up tasks, for actually aggregating information back together, for looking at ways in which people can collaborate effectively, even in this really fundamentally distributed fashion where participants may have no communication with each other at all.
Right. And Terry and Mike, we see each other at the Temple of Dynamics of Learning Center meetings. Again, timing is something that's crucial and important and is susceptible to this kind of analysis.
Timing, of course, is everything. And it's not just one time scale. There are things that are happening in your brain at the millisecond time scale. There are things that are happening as we talk on the second time scale. There's memories that we're forming right now that will be with us for the rest of our lives. And all of those time scales have to be integrated together. And there are different algorithms that our brains are using, and we need to be able to discover that allow all of these different time scales to be used, for example, to help improve education, to help communication, improve the ability of scientists and business people, schools, teachers, to perform better the functions
and
that they have.
Policymakers and politicians.
You know, this is so important, and this is something that really, I think, you know, if you think that we're being overwhelmed with data, just imagine what they're getting, right? Because they're dealing with problems and issues that are so far beyond any experience they've had, right? And how are they going to be able to take advice from so many different sources and come up with a policy? This is not
so,
an easy thing.
And as a concrete example, imagine something like the National Institutes of Health, which has 27 institutes and centers. A program manager working there, when they receive grant proposals and they have to make decisions about whether or not to fund that research, they not only have to know what's going on in their own center or their own institute, but they also have to know what's going on in every single other center and institute. And this is really time consuming. It gets to the point where it's very hard for people to just rely on their own expertise. They need ways of actually integrating and aggregating vast quantities of information to make effective decisions.
And I can tell you from experience, they don't always make the right decision.
Absolutely.
You mean you had proposals which weren't funded?
Yes, that proposal, yes.
I remember, go ahead.
So, although this
is your work as well, in terms of optimizing learning facts and so on.
Yeah.
And so
forth, yeah. I was just going to go from the level of groups and interactions among individuals to what's going on inside a single head, which is that if you can build models that can predict memory and performance and forgetting, then you can improve human learning and human performance. So that's a lot of my work involves trying to understand how the brain works, not just solely for the scientific purpose of understanding the brain, but then for leveraging that to optimize human performance.
Well, so do you think that the kind of work that's being done at the NIPS, at the NIPS level, actually finds its way into what you were talking about there in terms of societal organizations? I mean, you know very well that
I keep asking
people this question all the time. My administration will restore science to its rightful place.
So a couple of points of that. Firstly, you know, we have people like John who work for Microsoft, and they are producing products at the end of the day that are being used by people on a daily basis. So the fundamental research and technology that's taking place at NIPS is filtering down into these products that are then being used by huge numbers of people. Similarly, some of the work that I've been doing, I've been collaborating with people at the National Institutes of Health in order to make systems for program managers to make better decisions. So again, there, this is actually helping people who are not machine learning researchers at all make better decisions about how to allocate funding and stuff like that on a daily basis. So I think it absolutely does impact society on a day-to-day level.
Right. So the other question would be how much interconnection is there between these various disciplines? And I say this not to embarrass you, but you're one of 10 people who's actually a member of three national academies, Institute of Medicine, Institute of Engineering, National Academy of Sciences. I assume that they must talk to each other at some point.
Well, you'd be surprised. In fact, I'm being inducted into the National Academy of Engineering this year, and it turned out that they decided that they would hold their meeting at the same time as the Institute of Medicine holds its meeting, and they didn't know that, right? That shows you how little communications might be going on there. But you're right. I mean, the science has become balkanized, and as we learn more and more and more, there's only a finite amount that we can fit into any one brain, and so it just spreads out, and it's very difficult to know how to make these connections. And I think one of the values, I think, that we have at NIPS is the fact that it is possible to connect directly with others that you would never go to a meeting and meet, any other meeting, because each discipline, sub-discipline, has its own specialized meetings. But by coming to NIPS, you can go to a workshop and get a picture of what another field looks like. And often, and this has happened to me many times, I will pick up something that will have direct benefit to the work I'm going to be doing over the next year, and then that will lead to another submission to NIPS. And so that process, the workshops especially, are very, very good for that processing, for people to really develop new insights and new ideas, and then take that back to the shop and apply that and see what they find.
Devil's advocate for a moment. I read something here where somebody was saying that perhaps the name itself, in hindsight, although it was appropriate at the time, Neural Information Processing Systems, it's not just neural information that you're dealing with, is it? I mean, you're talking about the intelligence system, which has all sorts of bodily connections and so on as well. I mean,
it's true that neuroscience only makes up maybe about 10% of the papers at NIPS. And I think that historically, it came from this era when there was a tremendous amount of excitement this is a very interesting historical trend. So back then, we're talking about 25 years ago, artificial intelligence was dominated by logical, rule-based systems. And NIPS really provided a different paradigm. The idea was, let's look at the signals themselves. So let's look at, instead of focusing on low-dimensional models, let's look at thousands of dimensions. Let's look at data sets that were much larger than anyone had ever looked at before. And that really changed the way that we think about the problem itself. And now artificial intelligence has a rebirth, in large part because of the fact that machine learning has provided, for the first time, enough competency to actually take on some of these problems, like natural language processing.
John, you looked like you had a thought on that.
That's right. So I remember, I would say in 1987, because even before, in the mid-80s, there was, again, this tremendous excitement of, oh yeah, the brain does it. How does this how does it work? And it was very pre-paradigmatic in the sense of sort of Kuhn and Popper. No one knew what the problem was. And I think in 87, right when NIPS began, there was a light bulb that started lighting up over people's heads. It's statistics. It's not, and that's a lot of what sort of unifies a lot of what people do in NIPS, is that it's almost like a very aggressive branch of statistics trying to work on very hard, very large-scale problems. And that did come about, I think, because we realized, these AI problems, they're really statistical problems. They're large amounts of data. Let's try to do some very aggressive use of statistics to try to solve them as opposed to logic. Now, of course, now there's a lot of interesting work trying to bridge the two gaps back between, logic and statistics, and that's still a very open, exciting area.
If you go back to, let me pick a data point, Jerry Letvin, what the frog's eye tells the frog's brain, right? And Minsky, both working at the same time. How has the field shifted since then? You're saying it's become much more statistical, mm-hmm. algorithmic, and so on and so forth. Can you give me some historical perspective on that, Terry?
I was at a meeting that was organized at Dartmouth in, it was 1996, which is the 50th anniversary of a very famous summer conference that was held at the beginning of AI in 56. Right. And one thing that struck me was that every talk that was given by major, in every field, there was a similar theme. Takeo Kanada would say, well, I did my thesis on one image. I identified a tank in one image, but it didn't work on the second. But he said, now my students have millions of images from the internet, and they're doing a lot better. And everybody got up and had a similar story that their level of performance had been going up and up and up because of two things. Computers had gotten faster. Number two, much more data was available. But at the end of the meeting, Marvin Minsky got up and said he was disappointed at all of the talks and his former students. They'd given up on the real problem, which was general intelligence. And they were just trying to solve applications. Now, that was a bit overly dismissive, I thought, especially since we really have made progress. But it's clear that we haven't solved all the problems. And that's what NIPS is really heading toward in the future. It's clear that integrating what we've accomplished with some of these much more flexible, and someone mentioned the ability of humans to turn on a dime and to come up with a new way of thinking about things, conceptual frameworks, that's something we don't fully understand yet. And I think that's going to be the next frontier.
That was what I was asking you at the very beginning of this thing. To a general audience, does some of those papers, if you read them, it sounds reductionistic, but you're saying no, it's all in service of a larger perspective here, right?
Yeah, and I actually think that this will come full circle. So I think that where we are now is halfway. We're halfway through to a new paradigm. And the beauty of NIPS is every year there's a new approach that is going to give us better performance. But the excitement back in the 1980s was really the discovery that physics and computer science had this intersection that no one would have understood. I mean, the Hopfield network is basically a spin glass that was able to solve a computational problem. And gee, how could that happen?
What's a spin glass?
Well, a spin glass is something that the physicists talk about, which is a frustrated system of interactions between spins. But the point, though, is that this has really blossomed in the sense that now physics tools and techniques are being used to analyze machine learning algorithms. And now I think it's going to come full circle because the very same tools and techniques are being used to understand the brain. In other words, the brain is a massively parallel system. And neuroscientists, for the first time, can now collect enough data from enough neurons, thousands at a time, so that they can analyze the data using the techniques that NIPS is developing. And it's not just single neurons, it's fMRI data, EEG data, and it's revolutionizing the whole way we think about asking questions about the brain. We don't look at single neurons anymore, we look at populations of neurons.
You're actually Francis Crick Professor at the Salk Institute. We obviously knew Francis well. Francis shifted from genetics to neuroscience and eventually gave some sort of decency to the notion of studying consciousness, neural correlates of consciousness and so on. Does that kind of information get into your society or into NIPS, or is consciousness something that you would never go near?
I had a paper on computational correlates of consciousness.
Yes. Wonderful.
Yeah.
And problem solved.
Coming to a computer near you.
You can't solve the hard problems of consciousness, which is, what does it feel like to see red,
things.
The qualia problem. But there are many sort of concrete problems about sort of how does your brain process information that you're aware of that you can report versus information that you can't report that nonetheless has sort of indirect influences on your behavior. And so we can build computational models that explain those sort of phenomena, and they're phenomena that everyone would agree to are at sort of the core of consciousness. So there's been a lot of development, not only in neural modeling, but also in statistical approaches to understanding.
Did Francis ever go to NIPS?
I don't think so. We had Helmholtz Club meetings where we explored a lot of the issues. But I think specifically on consciousness, it's pretty clear that it's the tip of an iceberg.
Yeah.
And the part that we don't understand, the part that we're not aware of, is the unconscious. And those are the things that make vision easy. And that's why we're so bad at realizing, all the hidden stuff that goes on. It just looks like, you look out and you see an object and it doesn't take any effort. Tremendously difficult problems in segmenting objects from the background that haven't been solved yet. Although, and this goes back to an example, Paul Viola, the Jones-Viola face detector. It turns out that one of the most difficult problems was in a complex scene, picking out where the faces are. And Paul, using boosting, actually solved that problem. And it's now used in cameras. For example, when you aim your camera, it's able to locate where the people are. And in fact, there's even a camera out that knows if the person's smiling. And this is Javier Movellan's contribution to Sony.
Wow. Thoughts for going, where do you see this couple of decades from now? I mean, what's your sense of, because then you'll be running the thing in a couple of decades. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think the field is definitely growing.
Full of women, so.
Absolutely, yes, 50%. I think the field is really growing and moving in a whole bunch of different directions, and it's driven by continued availability and increasing availability of data, by increasing computing power, and also increasing understanding of mathematics and statistics. And it's really hard to know exactly where the field is going to be in 20 years, because so much of that is going to depend on what these developments bring and what people choose to do with them. Every year builds on the research from the previous years, and so it's very hard to be able to say, okay, well, in 20 years time, this is exactly what NIPS is going to be doing. But I think it's very clear that people are going to be working very hard on these problems and continuing to make really groundbreaking contributions.
But tell me, I mean, one of the things I hear all the time is, especially from people like Sydney Brenner, is that there's all that data out there, but it's just out there. Nobody's doing anything with it. How do you process all that stuff? There's more data than there are, you know, people.
Computers.
It's a difficult problem because now, you know, we have to do... We have to do, you know, parallel computing now because there is so much data. All the different human activities and computer activities in the world are generating, you know, terabytes and petabytes of data. So now we need to figure out how to take all our statistical algorithms, many of which were, you know, designed before the year 2000, and really bring them into the 21st century, where now we need sort of many computers working in tandem to operate on these enormous amounts of data. And so it's sort of an open research question, and that's some of us are working on.
Specifically on biology, I heard an interview, Charlie Rose interview with Paul Nurse recently. And Paul Nurse, as you know, Nobel Prize winner, he was the president of the Rockefeller, president of the Royal Society. Yeah. And Charlie asked him, you know, if you're a young man, what would you be working on today? And he said, you know, I'm a yeast biologist. And I always thought of the cells as being kind of mysterious things. I'd really like to know, how do cells manage information? Mm-hmm. In other words, biology has become an information science.
Right.
And as you say, it's an explosion of genes, of expression patterns. You know, it's the age of omics. And even the Salk now is heading in that direction. Very, you know, my colleagues come to me for advice about how to handle all these big data sets. And of course, that's exactly what NIPS is all about.
Well, you remember Sydney's story about omics sciences.
Yes, what a wonderful story. Do you want to tell it?
Well, it's very brief. I mean, he was asked by a journalist who worked for The Economist what he thought was the most important omic science. Was it proteomics or so on? And Sydney looked at the guy and said, "Econ omics."
It is. It's a bunch of people communicating via a signaling cache, a thing called money.
But presumably, I mean, this all fits together. I mean, you guys are not just doing this for the... I mean, obviously you're doing part of it for the love of it, but there's money here, isn't
there? By the way, some of our colleagues actually work for hedge funds.
Right.
And they come to the meeting, too, and that's they think they want to get an edge, right? Because high-speed trading, boy, if you can get the little edge on the information, you know, over the next millisecond, you can sort of do that and make a lot of profit. But it's clear that, you know, that if we don't figure out soon how to make predictions and make the right decisions, because it's going to really have an impact on the world. It used to be that, you know, a company can fail, but now, you know, a whole economy can fail if you make the wrong decision.
To what extent does the work that you do, do you think it would find itself into governmental circles and be accepted and be used for a greater societal flourishing?
So I just got back from the Political Methodology Conference, which is a group of political scientists who work on political methodology, and they are using techniques that come out of NIPS, many of these statistical and mathematical techniques for information processing, to analyze political systems, be they press releases, be they actual communications directly between people involved in politics. So there's definitely interest there in terms of government data.
I mean, it seems like a no-brainer, right? I mean, what would you possibly use to drive a society if it wasn't what you know about how brains work? I mean,
or statistics. I mean, I always go back to something Robin Hanson told me, which is he always viewed sort of Bayesian techniques of a branch of machine learning as the, you know, people are very biased and they have, you know, they have these sort of cognitive limitations, and these algorithms are your friends because they're going to sort of snap in and help you be less biased and make better decisions, that you'll become closer to an optimal decision maker. That's at least what Robin said.
All right. So last couple of minutes here. Give me some sense of your view of where NIPS is going. What's the...
I can tell you definitively, NIPS is going to South Tahoe in 2012.
After Granada.
There. You know, if I could tell you, I wouldn't tell you. If I knew, I wouldn't tell you, because...
You were involved right from the very beginning.
Yes.
In fact, talk about Ed Posner for a second, one of you. I mean...
Well, there you go. So. Ed really was the founder of NIPS in many ways. So he originally started the very first, as John mentioned, the very first NIPS meeting under the auspices of the IEEE Information Theory Society, of which he was a member. And I think that set the tone in terms of having the involvement of engineers, and that was continued till this day. But he was tragically hit by a truck while he was bicycling to work in 1993. And it was then I got a call. It was a complete shock, because he had been the general chair of the first NIPS meeting. I had just finished being the general chair of the second. And he had founded the NIPS Foundation. And they asked me if I could step in and help out, which I have taken over since then. And it's been wonderful over the years to see how NIPS has evolved and brought in a new generation of students and a new generation of ideas. And I don't see that ending. I see that this is going to continue. Now, you know, if you want to make specific predictions, you need to ask Hannah, because she's the one who's creating the future.
She's going to say there'll be more women involved.
One interesting thing that's happened in the last few years is that there's been a resurgence of interest in neural networks. And if you look at the neural network papers now, they're much more sophisticated, much more complex, much more ambitious. The results are absolutely mind-blowing compared to what was going on in the early 90s. And so I see this kind of spiral where you're spiraling up, and maybe we're returning to some of the techniques that have been explored previously, but the combination of computational power and new mathematics and availability of data just opens up sort of larger and larger realms.
Obviously, since we in 2010, the Science Network did all the Rummelhart Prize winners. So we were back with Jay McClellan, we were talking about Dave Rummelhart and so on. But then there were people there, you mentioned Josh Tenenbaum, talking about Bayesian stuff and so on. So the field is evolving and in a very interesting way, it seems to me. But that parallels what you're doing in NIPS, right?
You know, there's a theory called the virus theory. Ideas are like viruses, and they take hold and they spread, but they never become immune to them, and then it takes another generation to come along and suddenly rediscover the ideas. And when they do that, they're doing it from a much higher elevation, so that they can see the past and they can sort of create a new structure on top of that. And you know, it is a spiral, and I think that that's a lot part of history is follows that. And in the case of NIPS, it's a generational change, 20 years or so.
And interestingly, Dave Rumelhart, who is at the forefront of the early network, neural network days, inventing the algorithm to train complex networks, the last bit of work he was able to do was work that really moved in a probabilistic direction, where he was interpreting neural networks as computing probabilities and sort of loading probabilities directly into networks. And that foreshadowed a lot of what happened in NIPS in the years that followed.
Any final thoughts there?
I completely agree. I think that it's sort of statistics and math that unified them. I think that as the years go on, people try to be very rigorous and very careful about their statistics. And that's, I think, part of the reason why neural networks sort of left and came back is first they were seen, well, they're not really rigorous. Oh, no, they actually are. There actually is sort of math underneath them, and you can, you know, prove things about the algorithm. So it's sort of showing you sort of what's the part of the values of NIPS of being, you know, mathematically rigorous.
Terry, last word as president of the NIPS Foundation, a rallying call here, a promotional thing?
Well, I would love to see a new generation of students come here to Lake Tahoe. I think this is going to be a fantastic venue, both for the science and for the human spirit. In fact, having nature out right at your fingertips, I think, really is inspiring. At least for me, I see the work of nature is really being something to aspire to.
All right, great. Nice to talk to you all. Thank you very much.
Thank you.